From the Sky News Centre at 6, a mother who's the first person in the UK to be convicted of female genital mutilation has been jailed for 13 years. The 37-year-old was found guilty of cutting her three-year-old daughter at their home in East London in August 2017. The judge at the Old Bailey described it as barbaric. Lynette Woodrow is from the Crown Prosecution Service.
Her mother planned and arranged for this procedure to be carried out, and she knew it was wrong. Her daughter was seriously injured. She then tried to cover up her crimes by lying about what had happened.
The families of some of the 11 people who died in the Shoreham airshow disaster say they're disappointed a pilot's being cleared of manslaughter. Andy Hill's jet crashed onto the A27 in West Sussex in 2015. He says he's truly sorry. It looks like the EU's chief Brexit negotiator may be offering some concessions to the Prime Minister. Michel Barnier says the European Union will give the UK the option to exit the single customs union as long as a hard Irish border is avoided. Police investigating the murder of 17-year-old Jodie Chesney in East London have arrested a second person. Meanwhile, four people are being held over a stabbing in West Kensington yesterday. A new commercial astronaut capsule has returned to Earth, completing its demonstration flight with a splashdown in the Atlantic Ocean.
And there we have confirmation of splashdown. Dragon has returned to planet Earth. It is now back home. And you can see on your screen our two fast boats racing out to the capsule, now in recovery.
The SpaceX Dragon left the International Space Station carrying a dummy earlier on its final stage of the six-day test flight. And a vegan pie has been crowned supreme champion at the British Pie Awards for the first time in the history of the event. The curried sweet potato and butternut squash entry won the highest honour at the ceremony. That's the latest. I'm Laura Safe.
By BCFM 93.2... This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Gosling helping me review this week's news is Conservative councillor for Westbury on Trim and Henleys, Jeff Gollop. We're also joined this week from Bristol Food and Farming Group's Stephanie Weatherall from Bristol Food Producers and Humphrey Lloyd from the Land Workers Alliance. And in a little while by Labour Party Oxford economist and Irish Republican Martin Summers. After the 7 o'clock news, never mind the Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman's bloody role in Yemen, what about the Saudi role in the 9/11 attacks? We're joined by author of 9/11, The New Evidence, and organiser of a UK-based Reinvestigate 9/11 campaign, which is calling for a proper inquiry into the real perpetrators of the 2001 9/11 attacks on New York and Washington, which began the so-called War on Terror. That's terror. That's Ian Henshaw. Also, Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn calls for a ban on UK arms sales, not to Saudi Arabia, but to Israel. Why has he done that? And more importantly, why hasn't it been reported anywhere in the UK press? And also, links between the Israelis and the Indian government may have played a part in the recent bomb attack in Kashmir, inflaming tensions between the two nuclear-armed states. Why is veteran Middle East journalist Robert Fisk pointing the finger at Tel Aviv? And the Northern Ireland Troubles, possible reopening of the case against the British Army on Bloody Sunday in 1972, which kicked off the Troubles, many say, as the Northern Ireland Secretary, Karen Bradley, says in the Commons, the police and army are above the law and their killings weren't crimes. Is she still in her job? Yes, she is. At the same time as suppression of a documentary about the supposed loyalist Lochan Island massacre, with journalists being intimidated. That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows around 7 Celsius, some light rain. This weekend, highs around 11, light rain tomorrow, Saturday, strong winds, though, and also light rain on Sunday. Next week, highs around 11, mainly cloudy with some showers and windy at times. Well, it's like April weather in March, isn't it? Next weekend, 16th and 17th of March, highs around 10, sunny spells and more showers. April showers in March. Anyway, before we start tonight, I'm pleased to announce that Ofcom have ruled there was no breach of their Rule 5.13 after a complaint was submitted against this programme by UK Lawyers for Israel about the show generally and specifically about our broadcast on Friday the 23rd of November last year. The complaint by UK LFI's Jonathan Turner could have led to this show being taken off the air permanently, to BCFM charity being fined or made bankrupt, and having our licence revoked. But it included several falsehoods, including that we had said that the Manchester Arena bombing was carried out by MI5 and the Rothschild family, and that the Illuminati are infiltrating and controlling our governments. This is malicious exaggeration. Jonathan Turner said in his complaint that the politics show is filled with conspiracy theories, extremism, racism and propaganda, and in breach of multiple provisions of the Ofcom code. He said, "We identified and analysed 14 breaches of the Ofcom code in a single episode of this programme that is broadcast every week. This must be a cause for alarm. Ofcom should ensure that an extremist is not permitted a platform to spread his message of conspiracy and hate." That was Jonathan Turner in his deposition. UK Lawyers for Israel tried to shut me down as running a Nazi propaganda show, effectively, an inversion of the truth, which Ofcom have now refuted. So the substance of the actual Ofcom investigation boiled down to three issues. First, the peddling of conspiracy theories, which I explained is a meaningless term used to smear investigative journalists by conflating real conspiracies with fake ones. It was introduced into the US media in 1967 by the Central Intelligence Agency after the Warren Commission into the 1963 assassination of John F. Kennedy to cover up the CIA's role in the president's murder. Second, it was a lack of balance, they said, with regard to the state of Israel, which they were investigating. In response, I pointed out that on six occasions from August 2018, I'd aired extended interviews with five Israeli cabinet ministers, including the Prime Minister, more than any other UK radio programme, possibly. This was the most serious of the complaints because it alleged the programme was racist and anti-Semitic. In fact, the Prophet Muhammad instructed his followers to practice, much like the right of self-defence in international law, the self-defence jihad. This part of the Quran has been twisted by Salafist and Takfiri doctrines to justify sabotage and terrorism against one's enemies, even the killing of fellow Muslims. That's fairly well understood, and it was used to recruit people to ISIS, for example. But we decided to look at the other side of the coin, extreme fundamentalist Zionist doctrines, which some Jewish scholars call the twisting of Old Testament prophecy to justify war. I interviewed Canadian author David Livingston, who's just about to come out with another book examining these subjects, entitled Ordo Ab Chaeo, Latin for Order from Chaos. David argues some nihilistic Zionists actually want a Middle East war in order to evoke the Jewish Messiah, but they may end up evoking the Antichrist instead. This program includes many justifications for creating the State of Israel, not least of which is the Holocaust of 6 million Jews suffered by European Jews under the Nazis. But history teaches us that all religions can be hijacked by ruthless people for political and criminal purposes. And so the November program is taking a balanced look at the extremes of Zionists as well as Islamic pseudo-religious doctrine, which I'm pleased to say this station and last week Ofcom stood by. The final comment Ofcom decided might have merit was that the programme was biased against MI5. This programme aired on the week of Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee, chaired by Dominic Grieve MP's report into the London and Manchester terror attacks. Every mainstream press headline was critical of MI5, including the Manchester Press. And the show did include contrary views supporting MI5's innocence. So we're in the clear for now. Anyway, that's just a report for you from on our Ofcom complaint. So we're still here. We're not disappeared. And with me is the Conservative councillor for Westbury on Trim, Jeff Gollop. Hi, Jeff, and welcome to the Politics Show. Now, we've just had the budget at the City Council. What has been the Conservatives' role in that? Or do you just not get involved because Marvin can do whatever he wants?
Basically, Marvin can do exactly what he wants. We can put forward amendments, which we do, but we know that they will be not supported, and that effectively one or two minor amendments were supported from other parties, but not ours. And The budget went through with a 3.99% increase in the council tax. And there's really not a lot more to say. A great deal of debate about amendments, but very little debate about the meat of the budget and actually looking at the priorities the council should be setting and how it spends its money.
I mean, you've been involved for a long time and you've seen the transition to having an elected mayor. Is there a big difference between the way the budget settlement's reached in the city? I mean, this is, I think it's around about £330 million of our money you're spending every year. Is there much of a difference between the way the settlement's reached now and before the mayor arrived?
Well, the difference is more between the last mayor and this one. The last mayor was independent and could only get a budget through by persuading councillors or a majority of councillors to support or at least not oppose his budget. So actually there was a lot of negotiation and discussion that went on in evolving a budget to get it such that members would agree it. Now there is a majority within the Labour group and therefore whatever the mayor proposes we know is going to be adopted as the main budget. So it's actually that there is less ability to review and challenge and work up alterations than there was under the previous system where the mayor had no majority at all.
Now, it's really mainly cuts you're implementing. Do you ever feel a bit depressed? It's just like, what are we going to try and save? You must feel sometimes like you're a bunch of official receivers slowly closing down the factory.
It's worrying because if we carry on the direction we're going, the council will, in a period of a few years' time, only be delivering social services and it won't have budget left
for
anything
else. Well, they'll be collecting parking fines, I'm sure. They'll be still doing that, won't
they? Well, they'll be collecting that, but they will be collecting that and that will still be helping to support social services and regulatory parts of the budget. So there is a real issue there. However, we still believe there are more efficient ways of doing things. And I don't like being petty political, but one of the things we've noticed is the significant increase in the number of staff in the mayor's office and their payment. Now, I understand that the role of mayor has an enormous number of challenges, but actually, when we're seeing austerity impact on services the council delivers, to find that the mayor's team is growing doesn't quite seem to reflect what is happening elsewhere.
But
in the council.
But I mean, that surely reflects the fact that he's got more power than individual cabinet used to have, or individual members of a cabinet used to have before the mayor came along.
Absolutely, but also I believe that the budget for the support for the executive and the cabinet has also increased. So therefore, both have got more support. So I have a concern that that's not how it's going, and I use that as an example of how we should be looking at being more efficient in what we do and how we do it, and there is still scope to do that.
But I mean, these cuts are all your fault, aren't they, as a Conservative? This is something which is coming down from Westminster. It's called austerity. We were told there'll be no more austerity, and yet we're still seeing cuts after cuts after cuts. I was amazed to see the Mayor Marvin Rees yesterday on the Daily Politics show with Andrew Neil talking about them as savings, which is actually more of a sort of what the Conservatives would call them. But anyway, this is actually the Conservative Party's fault that we're having to go through all these cuts.
Look, we could have all sorts of discussions, and we have in the past, about that. The fact is that when the Conservatives came into power in 2010, the country was on the verge of a very serious financial position. And if you actually look at what's happened in the 8 years since then, as a result of austerity, the borrowing has been reduced. Now, if that borrowing hadn't been reduced, instead of spending the money on services, we'd have been spending the money on paying interest on our borrowers. So actually, there would have been no more money available for services. We just wouldn't have been in control. We'd have been in the hands of our lenders.
The national debt is now around about 1.7 trillion. So it's more than doubled since 2010. So that doesn't look as if that's been very prudent.
No, but as a proportion of gross domestic product, the figures are improving and are moving in the right direction.
Well, I mean, as more and more tax is squeezed out of the system, as there's an attempt to do that, to repay these debts, the national debt, surely that just means there's less money in circulation, businesses start going bankrupt, and you could end up in I think politely they call it a debt spiral, but I would call it a death spiral.
Well, I think the only thing is that businesses appear to be surviving, and more than surviving, they appear to in general be paying more tax than they did this December and January. So I think that things are very much still positive. Who knows what's going to happen as a result of Brexit, which will have an impact massively. But for now, I don't believe the economy is collapsing and the tax take is collapsing. But we have assured Marvin that we will work in any way with lobbying the government, because we recognise, as far as local government is concerned, that austerity has gone on for too long. And actually, it needs to be shared more with other departments and less with local authorities.
So if you were in Marvin's shoes, what would you do differently?
I would look at...
Would you like to be in Marvin's shoes?
Well, you know, I stood against George the first time there was an election. I worked with George. I can tell you that I now have no wish to fill that role whatsoever. It is actually a thankless job. It is impossible for one person to deliver all that is required, covering so many services. If you take the Mayor of London, they have some very major services.
He's got a cabinet, hasn't he? Marvin's got a cabinet. He's got about seven or eight people.
He has, but the responsibility still falls back with him. And therefore, the responsibility is far greater than that falls on, say, Mayor of London, for example, purely in terms of the number of areas of responsibility. Too much for one person to be responsible for.
Okay, get back to that original question, though, that I interrupted your answer very rudely, which is, if you were in Marvin's shoes, what would you be doing differently as a, not necessarily you, but as the Conservative group?
No, I think one would be looking at the way the council is managed, the levels of staff, and actually looking at how we can put more resources into frontline services. The tiers of management are still too high, and too many of them, and it's very difficult to justify to a resident why there are levels of staff at the top end of the authority being paid.
I mean, how many people
have
we got being paid more than, say, £100,000 a year then?
I haven't got those figures with me.
I mean, what sort of are the senior executives, how much are they getting, roughly?
I believe the senior employee on the payroll is in the region of 150K. I believe there may be others who are employed through an agency who may be being paid more.
Is it okay to employ people through agencies? Is that a prudent thing to do?
It would not be the route that I would be going down if it was me.
Okay, well, we're still just about talking about austerity. We're going to have a listen now to a chap called Paul Hazelden, who is not working there anymore, but he used to work at something called the Wild Goose, which feeds homeless people in the city. I was talking to him earlier this week, as he explains that he said there's been such a big increase in the number of people making demands for free food in the city for food handouts.
The numbers are increasing, people's situations are getting more desperate. We are seeing folk coming to the Wild Goose for food who have got jobs, who would be regarded as being respectable, ordinary members of society, but they just cannot make ends meet. And so this goes along with the increasing use of food banks. The cutbacks to the network of support that the state used to provide, people are struggling far more. They don't have the resources when things go wrong. They've got nothing to fall back on. And the fragmentation in society means they don't have family around, they don't have friends and neighbours who will step in and support. So they're absolutely stuck without mostly the faith groups who are providing the immediate support. And Trussell Trust food banks are fantastic, but it's an appalling indictment on our society that we need them so much.
Well, one of the reasons it's an appalling indictment, Jeff, is that we're the fifth richest country in the world. Why have we got people begging for food and having to go to food banks, desperate? And many of the people Paul's saying are actually in work. Talking about people out of
That's the bit that's unacceptable in particular. I mean, it's unacceptable that people are without food anyway, but that people are working and not able to earn sufficient to be able to provide for themselves is clearly unacceptable. And And that is why I've been persuaded to support living wage as a way of recognising the fact that we have to pay people sufficient for them to be able to afford to live.
Well, I'm also joined by Humphrey Lloyd and Stephanie Weatherall. First of all, Stephanie, can you just explain what is the Bristol Food Producers?
It's a cooperative made up of local farmers, producers, retailers, distributors, basically trying to increase the amount of food that's produced in and around the city.
So how much do we manage to produce here?
Not enough. There is some amazing kind of small-scale producers in and around the city, kind of urban, peri-urban, and then in the surrounding area, but we still import an awful lot of food into the city, the UK does more generally as well.
So are you talking about allotments, or are you talking about market gardens?
We're talking about market gardens.
Yeah, are there market gardens? You know what, I would actually quite be very happy to go and buy my veg from a market garden if I knew where it was. And I wonder, does that food come into the city centre through things like the farmers market?
So Bristol has a really strong history of market gardening. So the strip of land along the edge of the M32 is the kind of traditional market garden quarter of Bristol. That's what fed the city.
Is that healthy food next to the M32?
I think the soil is grade one agricultural soil, actually, and I think the pollution is really minimal.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah, but Humphrey's one of the growers who grows on that bit of land still. So there's still some small holdings and some market gardens up along there. But a lot of the food comes from some of the bigger farms, still small in terms of farming, a bit further away from Bristol. But there's lots of veg boxes you can get directly, the markets.
Now, do you want to plug a bit of this? I mean, whereabouts are the best places to go and get this food if we rather do that than go to Tesco's?
I think there's some great box schemes. So the Community Farm just outside Bristol, Lee Court Farm, Sims Hill, which is a community-supported agriculture project. All of those you can get regular veg shares or boxes. Humphrey does a salad scheme where you can get salad bag every week. There's shops like Better Food. There's a farmer's market. So the White Ladies Road Farmer's Market, Tobacco Factory, the Corn Street one are all great sources of local
food.
I'm
sorry, I don't know when they are. Do you? Off the top of your head?
Saturday is White Ladies Road. Sunday, I think once a month, is the Farmer's Market at the Tobacco Factory. And every Wednesday is the Corn Street one.
Humphrey, you're actually growing food next to the M32. I know you're going to be slightly biased here. I'm saying, is it safe? But is it?
Absolutely. If you think about the amount of atmospheric pollution that some fruits or vegetables grown by motorway have received, it's actually a lot less if they've basically been grown organically or agroecologically compared to a fruit or a vegetable grown on a conventional system that has been subjected to systematic fungicides, pesticides, herbicides, or what have you.
Actually, I remember seeing something horrific once. So it was an old documentary, maybe even from the 1990s or something, which was talking about some of the residues left on the food when we're buying them in a supermarket. And I'm hoping that you don't have those on your food.
Well, there's absolutely no residues on my food because I grow in an entirely organic and agroecological setting.
Do you have trouble with like little weevils and caterpillars and whatever eating and munching away?
Absolutely. The life of the market gardener is a constant struggle and battle against nature, the weather, and various other factors. But yes, of course, there are pest and disease problems. But as an agroecological grower, your kind of tools to resist those are things like diversity, crop rotation, soil health, soil microbiological diversity, rather than using an assortment and armament of chemicals.
Now, I know some people live near me. They've actually turned their front garden into growing, like spuds, blackcurrants, that sort of thing. You can actually do that fairly easily here in the city, can't you? It's not that difficult to do.
It's entirely possible to grow a certain amount of vegetables on a very small scale in your back garden, on an allotment, even on a peri-urban farm such as where I work.
Where would you suggest people start, though? Because I think sometimes it's like, what crop? Because we're at the right time of year, aren't we? Mm. What crop could go in? Like, okay, so dig the grass up or a few bit of the flower beds. What could you put in now, do you think, that might actually give you a bit of a return at the end of the year and it's not likely to just end up withering and dying and getting you really depressed and you never want to do it again?
Okay, so an absolutely crucial bit of advice I would go for if you're growing vegetables for the first time, either on an allotment or in your garden, is not to grow stuff that's susceptible to slugs. Okay, if you go in there with chard or salads, lettuce, kale, for example, the likelihood that you will lose a substantial proportion of the crop to slugs is high.
Slugs.
However, If you go instead for some beetroots, spring onions, potatoes, again, low labour input but quite high yielding crops that aren't so susceptible to pests and diseases that you find in cities like slugs, I think you'll have much better results.
We've got some sort of slug epidemic going on in Bristol.
Partly, like, if you're growing on an allotment, it's a really artificial site. It's not a situation that nurtures kind of natural things, like natural, like, hedgehogs and that kind of stuff. Like, I mean, back gardens don't have the predators for slugs in them because we've got walls and fences between them. Whereas I think most of the people who are growing on larger farms further out don't necessarily struggle with slug problems.
Okay. You're part of this thing called the Land Workers Alliance. What is that, Humphrey?
So the Land Workers Alliance it operates as a bit like a cross between a campaign group and a trade union to represent the political interests of small-scale and agroecological farmers. It's been a massive few years for us with Brexit because suddenly agricultural policy is being redrawn, and we as small-scale growers and people interested in agroecology are really having to sort of make the political case for what we do.
Well, I know, because I've been reading about this for years, and almost all of the subsidies and the policy seem to favour these massive farms. Like, the Queen gets like millions and millions, probably billions in subsidy. The obvious thing to do would be to sort of cap the amount of land, and that would really, I imagine, help the smaller growers, and actually maybe even cause some of the bigger growers to start dividing up their farms and open it to new farmers.
It's not even about capping the top, it's partly about uncapping the bottom. So at the moment you can't get any of the kind of cap payments if you're under 5 hectares in size.
Wow.
Which is quite large. A lot of people have a livelihood and living off a lot smaller.
How big is 5 hectares? I mean, an acre I know because it's a football pitch, but how big is 5 hectares?
And a hectare is about 2 acres.
Okay, 2.2 acres. Football pitches, okay.
Yeah. So you're talking about 10-12 acres. And you don't get any subsidy at all if you're under that size, which isn't actually, the Common Agricultural Policy comes from Europe, but that part of it was a UK decision to put that cap in place on the bottom.
Is it there in France, for example? Because I know France has got a lot of small producers.
So the situation in France is they've put the minimum claim area at 3 hectares.
Right. So,
however, I mean, this question now for us in Britain is basically immaterial because as we leave Europe, we leave the Common Agricultural Policy and the single farm payment that we're talking about here.
So what's going to happen? Any ideas?
Well, Michael Gove's new strategy is what he's calling a public money for public goods approach. So what that means is instead of receiving agricultural subsidies for either producing food, like they did back in the 80s, or simply owning land, as they've done from the mid-90s, what instead is we're going to have a series of agroecological payments. So what does that mean? What that means is farmers will not be paid to produce food or to own land, but rather to maintain good hedgerows, to maintain good soil biodiversity, to maintain a certain area of good pasture, to prove that certain nesting birds are nesting on their land, to essentially prove the environmental credentials and even the cultural credentials in terms of things like length of dry stone wool that their farm has. Now, in a way, this is very positive because it's a shift away just from a very unequal way of distributing farm subsidies, which was just paying the richest people, paying the biggest landowners. However, the danger of it is that it won't in any way be thinking about actual food production. Essentially, it says a lot about the environment, it says very little about food. And a country that already imports 40% of our food already is very insecure as a nation. What we really need to be doing is tackling two crises in the countryside, not just biodiversity loss and the loss of the environment, but also the loss of sustainable food production. And that's why what we really need is an agricultural subsidy system that recognises agroecology and organic and sustainable farming. Because that is the solution that brings together these two things, environmental biodiversity and the production of healthy, affordable food.
I mean, it seems we're in a bit of a post-industrial era now. Most of the big industries have gone, even in this city, certainly up north, and there's a lot of people that are twiddling their thumbs wondering what to do. Very insecure jobs. Is there actually a way for people to get into farming these days?
I mean, it's really challenging. There's a real lack of kind of training and opportunities, appropriate training, especially if you're talking about getting into kind of smaller scale farming.
Isn't there a big college up in Cirencester that teaches young men normally how to farm?
Yeah, it's very kind of conventional. Here's my tractor, I'm going to go and spray the field and do this rotation. But what's really missing is helping people getting into kind of small scale farms. I mean, in the past we had people returning after the war, kind of coming back and into small holdings that were provided for them to be able to run a livelihood off a small piece of land. But now there's a lack of appropriate training. Access to land is really difficult. Land prices are inflated massively. I mean, they've trebled over the last 10 years, I think. So actually setting up and starting is incredibly difficult.
And just to add to that, sorry, that the sell-off of county farms has happened absolutely nationwide, and definitely in South Gloss and Somerset.
What are county farms?
So county farms are a bit like council houses. They were traditionally small holdings that were owned by the council, but were leased out at sub-market rates to young people, what we call new entrants in the industry, who were trying to set up farms. Now, as part of the Tory austerity programme, much like council housing, nearly all county farms have now been sold off. We've seen over 200 sold off just in the southwest alone in the past 5 years.
Humphrey, can Britain feed itself?
Of course Britain can feed itself. However, the question is that desirable? Really, as a nation that imports 40% of our food, yes, that is an issue, and we should be looking to up the self-sufficiency of our nation. But we've been talking a lot about vegetables today. These are crucial. However, also what is crucial is upping our dairy production, upping our production of staple grains and other foodstuffs. There is always going to be a place for trade in the global economy. You know, we've been importing pepper from the India since the 15th century. And trade in itself is not necessarily a bad thing. However, unsustainable trade, stupid trade. For example, with the European Common Market at the moment, Britain exports roughly the same amount of bottled water as it imports. You literally have two boats passing each other, carrying the same product from Britain and out of Britain on the same days. This is a kind of trade that is just being promoted as part of the whole sort of neoliberal agenda of the global economy. And really what we need to get back to is a more appropriate agenda that is about sustainability and also social sustainability, which means good farm jobs.
Steph, what about Brexit? How is it going to affect things for you, if at all?
Well, I think I'm interested to see what's going to happen to food prices. I'm a little bit terrified to see what's going to happen to food prices, especially those that we import. I mean, I think it could potentially, locally produced food is one of those things that actually won't increase in price because it doesn't have any inputs coming in from further afield. So I am really hoping that it's going to see an increase in support for local farmers, an increase in markets and increased opportunities for people to get into that as a job.
Are there any examples around Bristol that you think people should, you know, pop in and have a nose over the wall and have a look at? Interesting little projects that are going on. This is one of the things that I've discovered over the years, is we've got quite a lot going on, mm-hmm. but it doesn't make a big fuss about it. People who live right next to it know about it. People who know people who go there do. But anyway, what would you like to point to anywhere that people might not have seen or heard of before?
I think there's some great opportunities if people want to get involved in volunteering as well. Like, you know, if you want to go and visit places, the city farms are great. Feed Bristol, which is the Avon Wildlife Trust, which is where Humphrey is based, is a really great project, and they do a lot of volunteering opportunities there. And that's a really interesting one because it's a demonstration of several different kind of growing projects, all growing in a really kind of biodiverse, rich, environmentally friendly way. And a lot of the farms outside, like the community farm, have monthly farmer kind of volunteer days, which are really worth signing up for if you want to actually understand a little bit about what it takes to grow kind of at a larger scale.
Humphrey, what do you get out of growing?
The benefits are multiple and various. One of them is not a big pay packet, to be entirely honest. However, you do have you have a healthy lifestyle, you have an active lifestyle, you have a lifestyle that's producing something that is genuinely needed and genuinely useful, and you have a true sense of the social value of what you're doing each day, each hour, each minute, which in the modern economy, in a place like Britain, in the global North Country like Britain, a lot of people don't get to say that about their daily work, and that is something I feel very grateful for on a daily basis.
That's Humphrey Lloyd from the Land Workers Alliance and Stephanie Weatherall from Bristol Food Producers. Thanks very much for joining us. Jeff, what do you make of what these two young people are up to, both really working on trying to make sure that we've got food growing still going on in an industry which is effectively dominated by some big industrial and agriculture giants, I suppose?
Well, I hear this, and it's exciting to know that it's happening. It's something we need to do. We need to be sustainable. So I'm just delighted that there is something happening, and you know, I would be happy to offer support in any way I could, because I just think this is such a good news story.
You might end up with some dirt under your nails, I'm afraid, at the end of the day, Jeff.
If you're relying on my green fingers, it would be less productive. But I just think in terms of opportunities, I would be very happy to see if there are ways we could achieve more.
What about Brexit, though? Because this is very unclear what's happening. Many people pointing at Theresa May and the Conservative Party saying, "Well, you started this, but you can't finish it."
Well, I would point that accusation to probably all 650 members of Parliament, in a sense, because there was a collective decision to have the referendum. Ultimately, the House of Commons made that decision. We're in a situation where the Prime Minister at the moment could not get a majority of the House of Commons to agree on any one proposal. Now, this is madness, because this is not what these people are sent to Parliament for. They're sent to Parliament to make decisions and resolve the direction of the country, not to object and oppose and to prevaricate.
So what do you think is going to happen in 3 weeks' time?
To be honest, I've heard so many people who claim to be experts and who actually have not the faintest idea, that I am not going to answer that question, because I could see any number of routes evolving. And I have no better knowledge than you or anybody else to actually arrive at that. So it would be inappropriate for me to say.
One of the Conservatives behind the scenes who's been very much a mover and shaker with Brexit is Oliver Letwin. He's the guy who penned a pamphlet probably 20 years ago now, or 15 years ago, about how to privatise the National Health Service. And he was on the BBC Week in Westminster last weekend, and he had some very interesting things to say about why he thinks that a no deal is now off the table.
I really don't think we are now going to have a no deal exit, one way or the other, either because the Prime Minister's deal is accepted by or on the 12th, or because we form an alternative majority and carry through a different deal. One way or the other, I think we will now have a Brexit. I don't think it'll be a referendum, with a deal that's been approved by the majority of the House of Commons one way or another. Having said that, we can now ask the hypothetical question. If the Prime Minister hadn't made this decisive shift, what there would have been is very severe risks, because most of what would have happened is not things we would have been in control of. It would have depended on the goodwill of people on the other side of the channel. And that might have happened to a greater or lesser degree. And that was the risk that I, for one, was not willing to subscribe to my country taking, because I don't think our country would have forgiven us, and I don't think it would have been right to forgive us. So you then ask the question, what would also have happened to the Conservative Party if that course had been followed, and if the risks had materialised, which is a further speculation, because they might or might not have materialised. And what I was trying to warn my colleagues, I've tried to warn them in a series of speeches over the last few months, is that it would not be somebody else, the EU, the Almighty, or whatever, the Labour Party or something, that would be blamed. No, it would have been the governing party. And I think under those circumstances, we would have had to expect a decade or two in the wilderness. Because if you think back to Black Wednesday, which is a similar sort of event where we didn't need to do what we did, and we did it because we made a series of errors. Nobody wanted it to happen, but they got themselves into a position where the logic led to that. What happened was that we had a succession of actually quite good, but anyway, Labour governments. On this occasion, if it had gone wrong, if the risks had materialised, it wouldn't have been 13 years or something of Blair-Brown governments. No, it would have been a Corbyn government. And so what I was trying to say to them is, it's not just a question of what would happen immediately to our country if the risk materialised, which is my main concern, nor just a question of what would happen to the Conservative Party, but what would happen to the country after the Conservative Party had suffered the consequences of those risks materialising, namely that it would be governed by Corbyn for a long time. probably a very big majority. And if you want to create circumstances in Venezuela, that's what you would have done. This is the reason why I was willing to go out on a limb with many others, work on a cross-party basis to prevent all that happening, because I really didn't think that that was a sensible way forward.
That's Oliver Letwin there talking about a no-deal Brexit and how much effort he's put in to stopping it. I'm pleased to welcome back Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, what Oliver's saying there is, he says the main, and you can say whether you think he's right or wrong, the main problem with a no-deal Brexit is it could be such a disaster that the Conservatives will be out of government for 20 years and Jeremy Corbyn could be in.
Well, from his own point of view, that's a rational analysis. I think, this, you know, obviously I'm a Corbyn supporter, so I'm not that frightened of a Corbyn government, but he is, and many people in the Tory party are, and Tory voters are. And, you know, he's basically, you know, from my point of view, that's a fairly rational, sober analysis from his point of view.
Do you agree with him?
I think he's right to say that a no-deal Brexit is likely. I mean, the CBI, the head of the CBI this week was saying it's going to cause global instability if there's a no-deal Brexit. And I think, as you know, I'm
domino effect, house of cards type thing.
Well, that's the danger, isn't it? Because there's all sorts of other things going on in the global economy. As we know, that, you know, trade war between China and the US and all the rest of it. But Brexit, in a sense, is storming a teacup in terms of those bigger things. But it just adds to the general instability of the setup. And, you know, this is a constitutional crisis of extreme proportions.
Well,
we've not seen anything like that since the Second World War,
have we? Certainly very, very different points of views in both the main parties and elsewhere. Also conservative, with a very different point of view, is former Work and Pension Secretary Ian Duncan Smith. And he believes there's no way that there's going to be an extension, and this is why. In other words, he believes we will have to leave on the 29th of this month.
Why would the EU want an extension for 2 months? Because that's not going to change anything. And if we did have 2 months, one way or the other, doesn't change anything either way. The reality is they're just about to go to European elections. They've reallocated all the seats that the UK used to hold. If we went longer than that, it would be absolute chaos in Europe. And then if we left a year and a half later, they would then still have to remain as MEPs, members of the European Parliament, even if we'd left, because there's no legal precedent for them to stay out. So the European Union knows desperately it does not want us to stay longer than the extra 2 months. And I think that they're going to say, look, if we've got a deal and you need a few extra weeks to get the legislation through, that's fine. But just staying an extra 2 months for no particular purpose is all by those who want to remain, who've never accepted it. They hope that there'll be a chance to have a longer extension of a year or two, and then they'll have a referendum. And I think that is the reality. So the answer is, I don't believe we're going to be extending. I think ultimately we will leave, and if necessary, we will leave without an agreement. That's a withdrawal agreement. We'll have an agreement very quickly, but we won't have a withdrawal agreement.
Jeff, do you think there'll be an extension just to allow a bit more time, or even a second referendum?
I haven't got the faintest idea, and you hear two senior politicians there putting totally opposite views, and those are just personal opinions on their part. They can't have any inside information on what is really going to happen, because at this stage, no one in Europe or in the UK knows. So my take, and you know, I have to keep things fairly simple to stand a chance of me comprehending it. My take is that if you were buying a car or a house, you would not issue press statements every day on what you were offering and what the other side was prepared to accept. So the only way you keep both sides interested is by offering what may be acceptable, but being prepared to walk away. So I can see that you would not remove no deal completely from the table, because given that just because no one wants it, if you remove it, you are then by definition agreeing that you will definitely have a solution, and that might involve having to give in to a lot more issues. So I therefore see this is all part of the negotiating ploy. As far as extensions concerned, I have a feeling the majority of people, whether they wanted to leave or remain, actually want a decision. This has gone on for too long. The damage it could do to the country and the economy if it carried on for months longer. So a couple of weeks if it was needed to put finishing touches, I could see. I would prefer it wasn't any longer.
Well, former Brexit Minister Steve Baker, he was in the House of Commons beginning of the year being interviewed by one of the, I think it was the Brexit Committee. He said one of the biggest problems has been that the civil service are running everything and the politicians are having to take a back seat.
There's been conversation about whether the current negotiating team should become more political. And I understand from a conversation, which I'm afraid I can't evidence, Sir William, but I will tell you that I understand that the pushback has been that this negotiation is being conducted by officials. It's officials on their side, so it must be officials on our side. Well, again, who governs? And I think we need to get, in our country as a whole, we need to ensure that policies... We always need advice. We need advice of the brilliant policy specialists that we have. But in the end, if power is going to be used in a way which meets with public consent, which is at the heart of this debacle over leaving the EU, then politicians must have the skills to deliver on the pledges they made and actually go and do it. So we do need to get more politicians into the negotiating team, but that will be resisted by those who wish to keep politicians out of it.
Martin, what do you make of what he's saying there? He said basically that we try as politicians, but actually all the negotiations are really being conducted by the civil service, and we need to get more politicians in there, people we've actually elected to do the negotiations rather than these civil servants.
Well, what's actually happening is, if you saw, Corbyn went to meet with Theresa May, and there's now talk of finding a cross-party consensus on some kind of Brexit which can be agreed. And that, if Steve Baker's saying that we need more politicians in this, does he mean more Labour politicians? I suspect he doesn't. He means his politicians, the people of his stripe, rather than broadening the tent.
Can you just answer, though, also what Jeff was saying there about it's bonkers taking no deal off the table, because Jeremy Corbyn wants no deal off the table.
Well, you'll find that the majority in Parliament, we're going to find out whether there is a majority in Parliament to close no deal off. And it's pretty clear what the industry wants. They don't want that at all. And, of course, from my point of view, I would go with Oliver Letwin on this. If there is a no deal and it causes chaos, we've already lost, for example, Honda in Swindon, Land Rover, etc. From a Corbyn point of view, a no deal Brexit which crashes the economy is just about perfect storm from our point of view.
Also, well, one of the people that Steve Baker was talking about there is called Lord Peter Ricketts, and he was on Hard Talk this week with Stephen Sacker. It was quite interesting to see what former French and NATO ambassador for the British government, and also former National Security Advisor to David Cameron, and former head of the Foreign Office had to say, because, you know, these people, the Mandarins, they're behind the scenes the whole time. We hardly ever get to hear them, but here is Lord Peter Ricketts.
The fact that the country is going to be worse off, and in my view probably less secure as a result of leaving the EU, and I thought in a democracy that you had a regular consultation of the electorate and that people were able to change their mind.
No, forgive
as
me,
they that,
that's,
learned the
that,
facts.
That's parliamentary democracy. It's not this referendum, direct democracy, where, as your former boss, David Cameron, made very plain when he set upon this policy of a referendum, he said, this is a once-in-a-lifetime decision. Do not think there is going to be a second chance. He was quite explicit about it. He told the British people, this is your one-time opportunity to decide whether you want Britain to be in the European Union or not.
Well, that's what David Cameron said, but I think since the whole campaign was based on a series of propositions that have turned out to be just flat wrong, and that some of the issues, like Northern Ireland, barely figured at all in the campaign, given that this is such a moment of rupture in Britain's relations with the rest of the world, that I think it's not unreasonable at all that people should be presented with the deal and offered the chance to give their opinion. And if their opinion is, in the light of this deal, we still want to go ahead, then I'm certainly not going to oppose that.
I mean, if I may say so, much of what you say and much of your view about the, as you would put it, the deceptions and lies that were told during the original 2016 campaign is subjective. I mean, it's your view. It's not provable. It's not scientific. You just feel that deceptions were made upon the British people. But they, on the other side of this argument, the Brexiteer side of the argument, would say that you, right now, and your fellows, in some of the most renowned sort of experts in the country, so-called, are peddling misconceptions, even deceptions, about the downsides of leaving the European Union.
Well, maybe they do say that, but if you look at
what they certainly do.
Businesses are doing, people with a lot of money invested and a lot of money at stake in the UK, they are making decisions which suggest that they are very worried about the uncertainties created by Brexit.
Well, some are making decisions which are not welcome in the UK, taking money out. Others are putting whole lots of new money in.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, we will see, but I note a lot of major investors in the UK are now deciding to move their business outside, to move jobs to other European capitals. And so they clearly think that there is something difficult about
Brexit. Yes, but that's what I'm really trying to get to. It's all subjective. You see all the downsides. Many other people see sunny uplands, and they're not just ideologues of the Brexit right. They're economists like Liam Halligan. He says right now the public finances are on the mend despite all the Brexit uncertainty. There's a healthy surplus. Employment's at record levels. In fact, if you look at UK growth, it's outstripping France and Germany right now. He says investors from China to the Middle East are flocking to this country. Forbes magazine's just declared Britain the best place in the world to do business. These are all realities that you choose to ignore.
I am not claiming that I have absolute truth on this. Everybody's view on this is subjective. We will see. We haven't left the EU yet, of course. We are beginning to see some of the effects of businesses deciding that they will move their business outside. Yes, for the moment, you know, unemployment is high. The growth is not spectacular, but it is not disastrous. That's great. We haven't left the EU yet. And we still don't know what the future will be. I am simply offering my perspective on the basis of my experience and what I see and hear from abroad. And I've never claimed to be speaking, you know, absolute truth rather than subjective.
I'm trying to be quite forensic about the nature of your argument, though, because you say that categorically there has to be, and it is indeed legitimate to argue for a second referendum, because you say it is now quite clear how damaging a Brexit would be. And there are, of course, different forms of Brexit, but you seem to think any form of Brexit would be deeply damaging, and that's your justification for a second referendum. My point to you is that your conclusion about the negativity of Brexit is so subjective that it surely can't undo David Cameron's promise that this would be a once-in-a-lifetime decision.
But are you saying that my view is so subjective that I shouldn't make it available to people to consider?
No, I'm just saying it may lack credibility.
Well, yeah, maybe it does, but it's what I believe. It's what I believe people need to be aware of. I believe that the Brexit deal on offer in the Prime Minister's negotiated deal is certainly better than leaving with no deal at all, but is sufficiently damaging to Britain's future prospects that it is worth giving people a chance to confirm or otherwise the view they took on the basis of, frankly, a very skimpy campaign in 2016.
That's the former, head of the Foreign Office, all sorts of things, a top Mandarin, Lord Peter Ricketts, speaking to Stephen Sacker. Fascinating interview, and I'll put a link up to that on our show page. I think you've got about a year or something to watch it on the BBC for a change, which is quite nice on the iPlayer. What do you make of these civil servants, Jeff? Do you recognise that maybe we're electing people who aren't actually in charge of the negotiations, that the civil servants seem to be running things?
I would expect the civil servants to have the expertise and the intellect to carry out the detail, but I would expect them to be doing it under the guidance of the ministers that they're accountable to. And I don't think we have any knowledge of whether that is the case or not. We don't have the evidence. We have the say-so of one person, and I don't think there's enough clarity that that's the case.
Also, on the Peston programme, Anoushka Asthana, she does a very good summary actually every week of the numbers game in the House of Commons as to what the situation is looking like for next Tuesday's Brexit vote, the Theresa May's final, apparently, Brexit vote, and as to whether she can get it over the line. So let's have a listen to Anoushka now.
It is just 23 days now until Brexit, and next week is critical when Theresa May has a second go at getting MPs to support her deal. She sees her main task as persuading her Conservative Brexiteers, with her Attorney General Geoffrey Cox in Brussels trying to get some sort of time limit on the controversial backstop. That looks difficult, but even if he does succeed, I can show you that it is still going to be a very tough vote for the Prime Minister. After all, the majority last time was 230. Here are all the groups that voted against her: Labour, SNP, Lib Dems. Critically, 10 members of the DUP and 115 Tories, some Remainers, but mainly Brexiteers. To win next week, she needs to change 116 minds. So imagine Cox does get something good. Then we've done our calculations and we think she could win over a large number of the European Research Group of Tory Brexiteers and 10 DUP. But that still leaves her short. Let's add on an additional 10 Labour MPs who we also think could possibly flip over. Still not quite there.
Martin, what do you think is going to happen next Tuesday? Is she going to get it over the line?
It doesn't sound like it from the analysis we've just heard. And of course, she's keeping no deal Brexit on the table because she's then going to come back getting closer and closer to the deadline and using that as a kind of, you know, to blackmail her own party, really. But of course, this guy, the Attorney General, has been over to Brussels to try and argue about the backstop. He's trying to use legalistic arguments with them, claiming that it breaches European human rights law. And of course, the EU officials are just rolling their eyes. And of course, the Irish are not going to stand for any of that.
On the 29th, are we going to leave or not?
I think if I was a politics teacher and I was teaching sixth formers, this would be a fantastic sort of lesson. It's a lesson in civics for us all, isn't it? Yeah. It's a constitutional crisis of the highest order. We've not seen anything like this in this country since maybe, you know, the breakup of the UK in the 1920s with Ireland splitting and all the rest of it.
Isn't it just simply because the result of the referendum is not reflected by parliamentary politicians and the Parliament is not prepared to implement the decision?
Yeah, but I mean, don't forget that Northern Ireland voted to remain, and so did Scotland, and the Welsh Assembly has already called for a second referendum.
Buy that, Jeff, that argument?
Oh, and so did Bristol vote to remain. So I mean, there is a massive division. I would rather we were having the chance to remain, but I believe there is a real problem if the House of Commons goes against a vote that was taken in the referendum. So therefore you've got an issue which could result in the House of Commons being alienated. We also have a problem that any call for a general election is an interesting one because both the main parties are split and the Lib Dems aren't split, but they are appearing to be incidental to the process. So actually, what would one be offering electors? And there's a great deal of settling down and patching up within the parties before one can actually offer a democratic choice to residents. So I think that eventually, by a lot of bluff, there will come to a stage where a vote just squeezes through because no deal would be considered intolerable. That's how I think.
Finally this week, we must talk about a Labour anti-Semitism row because we've also had Margaret Hodge weighing in here on Channel 4 News earlier this week, who's a Labour MP, long-standing.
Do you believe it is acceptable for Labour members to intellectually be anti-Zionist, to believe that the creation of the State of Israel was a mistake and that it shouldn't intellectually exist? Or is that anti-Semitism in your view?
I think that verges on anti-Semitism. I think it is perfectly possible.
Verges or is?
I think probably is where I'd come down on that. I think what is legitimate is to be critical of the governments of Israel, but I think denying Jews the right to self-determination in their own state is very difficult in the light of all the pogroms.
Well, when the State of Israel was recognised in 1948, they were given borders by the UN. In the war that followed, they captured substantially more than they were originally offered. Originally, they were offered an area on the coast of Palestine where the Jews were not a majority, but that's where they were mostly situated. You could argue that that was a poor decision. In fact, at the time, many politicians in America and the US and Britain didn't agree with it, but they went along with it because there wasn't much choice. But of course, they immediately extended that. They then extended it in 1967, the capture of the Golan Heights in...
So is it anti-Semitic or not?
No. What I'm trying to say to you is the state of Israel is like the state of Serbia. It's actually, it's not just a state, it's actually aggressing other communities adjacent to that state. And we went to war with Serbia when I was an aid worker in the 1990s in Bosnia. We went to war with Serbia. We had a 73-day bombing campaign that killed 10,000 people.
So it is or it isn't anti-Semitic?
It's not. Okay. It's political argument.
Let's listen also to the Peston programme, Mark Francois, Conservative MP, and the Labour MP, John Mann, on this very point.
With regards to Corbyn and Labour, let's be frank. Jeremy Corbyn is an anti-Semite. He hates Israel. He never talks to the Israelis. He talks to Hamas. He talks to Hezbollah. The Labour Party will never solve the problem of anti-Semitism, which is endemic now, hang on, while he is its leader, because he personally cannot solve it because he suffers himself from the disease.
Well, let's be absolutely clear. There are many people who would argue that criticism of Israel is not the same thing as anti-Semitism. I mean, I think, John, would you agree as a Labour member that Jeremy Corbyn is actually anti-Semitic?
I think the problem with Jeremy Corbyn is that he hasn't given the decisive leadership that's needed.
But does that make him an anti-Semite? I mean, would you not want to take Mark on this?
That doesn't make him an anti-Semite. It makes him a poor leader, and it's leadership that's needed.
Can I just come in? Because I think there's a really critical issue here. There's a danger we're being too politically correct all the time. And we have to get a fair balance. There is no justification, whether it's being anti-Semitic or it's being Islamophobic, there is no way that it's tolerable for people to make offensive comments to others. But there should always be the possibility to challenge another government or another country or have an opinion on those thoughts, as long as it is expressed in a civil way that doesn't hurt the feelings of one or a group of individuals. And what's been going on in the Labour Party, if one believes what one reads, is some quite frightening comments that clearly are offensive and are hurtful. So I think the difference between the Israeli government and what one says and being anti-Semitic are two very different things. But we've got to have give and take, but it's got to be fair.
Time for the US-owned Comcast News at 7 now. Thanks to our guest that you just heard there, Westbury-on-Trim Conservative Councillor Jeff Gollop. Also, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Join us after the US-owned Comcast News as we spread our wings around the world.
An award-winning community radio station for Bristol. Bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.